Hey there, this is Seth Juarez from Channel 9 coming to you from the beautiful Cambridge office here at Microsoft. And we are talking all about data science here because that's what you guys do here in this office, right?
Absolutely.
So tell us who you are and what you do, my friend.
So I'm Mary Wall. I just started at Microsoft in February from a postdoc in computational biology. And I'm here today to talk about predicting traits from genomic data.
See, this sounds super fancy. So we're going to start out by sort of laying the groundwork of what all of this stuff means, what it is we're trying to predict, and then we'll get into how you do it, okay?
Okay, sure thing. Yeah, so I'll start from the basics of biology, because I bet some people would like a refresher on, you know, what a genome sequence even is, right?
Yeah.
You know, in each cell of your body, you have two copies of the instructions that make all of the contents of that cell, and therefore, you know, since your body is made up of cells of your whole body. And those instructions look like, you know, a set of chromosomes, and on each chromosome, you have base pairs that are A's, T's, G's, or C's, mm-hmm. in a particular order.
Mm-hmm.
And so most of those sites don't vary much between people. But if you want to be able to predict traits, you want to know where all the variation is and have some way to write that down efficiently in a file so that you can do data science and machine learning on it.
So just to back up. So everyone has instructions in their DNA, for example, that has a sort of a string of letters, for example.
Yeah.
And you're saying that everyone's almost exactly the same except for a particular parts.
Exactly. So you might have 3 billion base pairs in the entire set of instructions, and of those, typically for a study, we might be looking at only 1 million. Now, those are all sites that we know tend to vary between people, so it's the kind of variation that makes, for different traits for people from different continents, rather than looking at brand new mutations that might have happened only in you. It's easier when we have the numbers from more people having each mutation to do the sort of data science we want to do.
And then the next question was, when we're trying to predict traits, what is a trait? What does that mean?
Okay, so there are two different kinds you could think of. Things that are very discrete, like you have blood type A, B, or blood type O. And then there are things that tend to vary continuously, like you might be trying to predict someone's height or weight. For real-world applications, there are things like forensics, like you have a blood sample at a scene, can you tell what this person would have looked like? So that's a combination of things like hair color, eye color,
sure.
and things that vary continuously. You might want to be predicting what's somebody's propensity to get cancer, or if they have cancer already, what's the probability based on its particular mutations that we can treat it with a certain drug? And even things like agriculture, can we tell what mutations a plant has that make it grow better that we can then try to breed into other plants on purpose?
I see. So a trait is just sort of a physical manifestation of something on a person or any kind of biological thing.
Exactly. And we'll assume that's easy enough to record. You have some identifier for each person and you make your measurement and you write it down. That part's easy enough, but representing the genome is a little harder to understand, I think.
All right, well, let's get into that.
Okay, so like I said, you have this, each chromosome looks something like a string of A's, T's, G's, and C's. And you probably remember the Watson-Crick model. This thing is a double helix of things that are paired to each other. And so you have a copy from mom, let's say, and a copy from dad. And most of these sites between mom and dad, they're not different at all, right? But let's say there's one site in this region that I'm focusing in on that is different. So in mom's case, you have a G and a C pair. And in dad's case, you have an A and a, pay too much attention to that, A and a T pair. And so what we want to record out of this is not any of the sites that are the same, because that would make a file that is far too big. But we can say, all right, maybe this is chromosome 1, and we're down at base pair 3. So for this person, I would write down in my file that on chromosome 1 at base pair 3, they have an A and they have a G. Right? So there's basically two things that I'm recording for that one site, the two different copies from mom and dad. And then I'll go down to my next site that's different, and I'll write in what the person has there. So maybe this person has two of the same things from mom and dad. And so I write that down in my file. And this is where we start from in terms of representing the variation of that person. So we're already excluding all the other sites that are not interesting to us in order to write this file.
So looking at base pair 3, we're writing down A and G because that's where they're different, but it looks like there's a C and a T here too.
Yeah, I totally understand where you're coming from there. So we sort of have to arbitrarily pick one end of the chromosome to be where we're starting from, and then have one of these two strands be the one that we're actually recording from. Because this would be totally correlated information, right? There wouldn't be any extra information from writing what was on the other strand since they have to pair with
each other. So you're just looking for the base pair that's different. You're writing down one end of it.
Yeah.
But we're not going to write down the other end because it's not going to really add any additional information because they're super highly correlated.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Cool.
Yep. Okay. So now we've got a file that looks like A's, T's, G's, and C's like this for each person, but we want to convert that into something that we can more easily use for with traditional techniques from machine learning and data science. And so for that, we want to write this down in a numerical form. So what we're going to do for each of these sites is pick in our data set one of the two possible sequences there to be a reference and another one to be a variant.
Okay.
And then we're going to write down what is the number of variants that each person has. So maybe this is person one, just so that I'm clear. And this is person two.
Okay.
Because we're going to use the same variant and reference allele for each person.
What's an allele?
Yeah. Oh, sorry. So an allele is the sequence on one of these two chromosomes at that site that we know varies.
So that would be allele GC.
Yeah, exactly. A G or an A, we'd say, how we might name those two, two alleles. So in this case, I'm going to pick for position one that the reference allele is A. And in this case, I'm going to pick that the reference allele is T. And I'm going to write down for each of these people how many of the non-reference alleles they have at each of these sites. So my new matrix would look something like 1, 0, I guess this is a 0 and the 2, exactly. Okay. Yeah, so person 1 and person 2. And so now what you can see is instead of having two columns for each of the positions in the genome, I only have one. And I've converted data that was in a character form into something that is numeric. And so it actually kind of makes sense to think of the effects of these mutations as being additive in a lot of cases. And the reason for that is, let's say a mutation comes around and it knocks out a gene, so now you can't make that protein anymore. Since you have two sites in the genome, knocking out one copy might really mean that you only make 50% as much as you would otherwise. So you have this sort of linear effect that could be based on the number of alleles at each of these positions.
A couple of questions. So you said the reference allele is going to be A here.
Mm-hmm.
And so in position one, we have one A here, right?
Exactly, and then a G. So we're going to count the number of variants, so non-reference.
So that would be one here. But this person two has two A's, right?
Exactly.
So why is it a zero here?
Oh, okay, so in this case, the reference we chose was A, and we know that the other thing that could be there is a G. So we're counting the number of non-reference alleles. What contributed to the one here is actually the G, not the A.
So we're just counting the difference.
Yeah, exactly.
And so for here, since the reference gene is A, is it gene or reference?
You could say allele. Maybe allele is the best.
The reference allele is A. There's one difference here.
Yeah.
No difference here because that's it.
Exactly.
Here we have no differences because they're all T's. Here we have two differences because
Yeah, that's exactly right.
That makes sense. Okay.
And so typically what we do then, some of these things will be, these variants might be more common or less common. Typically we'd take each of these columns and normalize it. So so instead of being values between 0, 1, and 2, now it's, centered to 0 and it has a standard deviation of 1. And that just means that things that are more or less common, won't have, a greater variance or a different mean.
And the other thing that you were mentioning is that this actually makes sense sort of theoretically because the change here is just 1, right? And there's no change here.
Exactly, okay. And so maybe, if the trait, corresponding to A is lower overall, that might mean that we have to, shift our predictions all by some constant factor. And so we'll have basically an intercept term that represents the population mean to fit. And that's how we deal with the fact that maybe, that we don't know in advance which of these is actually causing a change.
I see. So you look at everybody and then you mean shift everything over, you normalize these columns, and suddenly now you have effectively sort of clean data from the genome or from people's What do you call it? People.
Yeah, genome's a great term for that. Yeah, exactly. So it's cleaned up, it's in a numeric form, and now we can predict on these just like they were features in any other linear model. And now we'll probably miss out on some things. Like you can easily imagine that two mutations might have to both be present in order to get some change in phenotype. If you have one mutation, then another might not matter, right? Like if you were bald when you were born, it doesn't matter that you have male pattern baldness, or you're not going to get balder. That sort of trait. Is not something that's captured very well by linear models, but we can still, for a lot of things, we can use a model with data that look like this.
I see. So once you have this, then you have like probably a lot of these. How many columns? Is it a million about?
It can be about a million. So I'm going to show you an example a little bit later where we use a smaller data set just so it will roll really fast. Sure. But we've got going to do it on a virtual machine that you can scale up to use whatever kind of resources you need for your own problem. And for a lot of studies, that's on the order of a million and maybe hundreds of thousands of people for the larger studies.
So all of a sudden, like, and maybe correct me if I'm wrong, but if I'm doing machine learning on a million columns, and 1,000 rows, it feels like that there's going to be a problem, right?
Absolutely, right. It's really easy to overfit because you have so many, combinations of features there. It's really easy to pick, overlearn patterns that aren't really there from your training set. And then when you go to apply them to, in the real world, like to a person that you didn't use to train your model, you're going to see that those predictions are not so good. And so the tricks that data scientists might be most familiar with to avoid overfitting are things like regularization. So if you have a linear model, this is almost certainly a technique that you will apply where you're just trying to prevent the effect sizes for any of those sites from becoming unrealistically large. And that's actually not the approach that that I'm going to show you today. What we're going to use instead is trying to account for another type of overfitting that's very common with this model, which is dealing with population effects. So you can imagine that when we're predicting a phenotype, some of these things will depend on the environmental conditions someone was in, or something like whether a person was a woman or a man, where did they grow up, things like that. And you can try to account for those in a linear model by just adding on, in addition to all these features from the genome, a bunch of features that represent those extra traits. But if you don't add enough of them, you can wind up accounting for those effects from the environment with the genotype. Features that you've added instead would just be projected on. So an example might be that if you use a population that it's genome sequences from all over the world, and in one population people eat a different type of food that predisposes them to a disease, then it might look like sites in the genome that those people from that population have. The genome sites are what's causing the phenotype rather than the dietary differences that are actually there. And so this helps to avoid that by just basically adding on a catch-all, basically a random effect term that can be correlated between people. And so that will wind up being fitted for these sort of population level.
So it's like adding a new feature to sort of it's like regularizing with another feature.
Exactly, which is, maybe counterintuitive, but that's exactly right. Again, adding on these extra random terms.
So for those that might not know what regularization is, would you want to explain that a little bit?
Oh, okay, sure. So normally when we are fitting these models, you can imagine trying to fit a effect size for each feature that it will maximize the likelihood of seeing, a set of data, that you already have in hand. Regularization, adding on regularization basically says, I don't want to just maximize that, because if I did, maybe my fixed effects would be too large. But I also want to make sure that I'm limiting this by preventing adding on an extra term that prevents those things from becoming too large. So we wind up trying to minimize something that adds on a term that's typically like a square, the sum of the squared effect sizes. And that way, if we wind up with very large effect sizes, that square term will get too large and our model will be bad. And so we're basically finding some sort of balance between having fixed effects that are too large and making the likelihood of our data larger.
I see. So we're just adding effectively new terms to help balance sort of the tension. We're adding some good tension in the models.
Yeah, exactly.
So once you have these things, and you said that it could, in good problems, it's like a million of these. In our problem, we're sort of making it a little smaller just to see the whole process. Yeah. Once you have these, what do you do with this data then? Because we're looking at it's a regression problem, right?
Yeah, exactly. So we're going to use a particular type of method called factored spectrally transformed linear mixed models. Okay. And so I'll sort of break down what that term means. But first of all, I want to say it's a package that was developed in Microsoft Research. David Heckerman, Jennifer Lisgarden, and other researchers that worked with them helped put together this package. And so I'm not going to talk about the details of why that package is much faster than what was available before it, but I do want to say that it opened up being able to use data sets on that size.
Sure.
So what the name means, the linear mixed model part sort of describes taking a linear model, which would just be trying to predict, let's say, y is a phenotype from a mean term plus some effect size for the first locus in the genome plus some effect size for the second. Oh, that's an X, sorry. Mm-hmm. And so on, right? Adding on to typically there would also be some error term at the end, right? That would represent some noise and be a departure from a perfect linear fit.
Sure.
We're going to add on an extra random effect that I'm going to call gamma here.
Sure.
And this is so what's mixed about this model is basically adding in that extra random effect. And so these are going to correlate between people, and we're going to need to figure out how much they should correlate. If we had a family tree, we would know that a mother child would have to be 50% correlation, but we're going to have to figure that out from the genome sequence. And that's one of the ways that a fast LMM package makes this much more tenable for large data sets.
So let me see if I understand. Yeah. So we have, this is a straight linear model, and we're trying to find how much an effect these positional differences in each allele are going to affect a particular trait.
That's exactly right.
So we're going to make sure you keep standing this way. I want to make sure they get everyone to see your face. So once we have that, what is the challenge? As you mentioned, the challenge is that we have a lot of columns, not enough rows. Can you describe that problem again and how we solve it with this other thing?
Oh, okay. So the trick here is we have, and I don't know if the whole equation was actually captured.
Yeah, we can see it now.
Oh, okay, perfect. Yeah. So the problem is these random effect terms that correlate between people. We know that they are going to be centered at zero, but we don't know what the correlation should be between people, and we need to be able to figure that out fast. Which, if you have 100,000 people, you don't want to be doing 100,000 choose two pairwise comparisons to figure out what all those similarities are.
Yeah.
And so that's their contribution is doing basically avoiding having to calculate explicitly what that similarity matrix is, and instead going straight to a spectral decomposition of it. And that's the ST part, the spectrally transformed part.
And is that what the gamma is, that correlated stuff?
Yeah, so these so if you have if I imagine a whole matrix of these, capital gamma, so there's the gamma from person one, the gamma from person two, and so on. This will look like, what I want to say is these will be distributed sort of normally with mean zero.
Uh-huh.
And they'll have covariance that will depend on how related these people are to each other. So since we're going to try and figure that out from their genome sequences, we're just comparing these things to figure out how much of the genome do they have in common.
I see.
And so it's this correlation matrix that's the problem. I think in their original paper they call this K.
And that thing is going to be 10,000 by 10,000 if you have 10,000 examples, and then you're going to have to find the correlation between each of them and do some kind of algebra for each spot. And so you're doing order n squared type calculations.
Exactly. And so that's what they're avoiding. So they can get this down to be linear in the number of people by avoiding explicitly calculating it and going right to a decomposition. And that's the decomposition is what they use to fit, ultimately to figure out what these beta terms are, what the overall variance is for, that's due to random effects and due to error.
And effectively, this K needs to be added because of the fact that we have so many columns, not enough rows, and we need to add some kind of regularization term.
Yeah, exactly, and deal with this population structure. Yeah.
Got it. So now, walk me through how we go from here to use these numbers in machine learning.
Okay, so it's in actual practice, it couldn't be easier. It looks just like applying something from SciKit, SciKit-Learn. So you can supply data in this format. You can actually supply it in the original format.
Oh,
so if
nice.
You're a biologist, you hand them something that looks like this, and you can train a model. Now, it used to be the case that most of these things would spit back out just the fixed effect terms, mm-hmm. And so you would you'd have to sort of recode all of that to make sure you'd normalized it and transformed it to look like mm-hmm. this in the same way. But what's really great about this FastLMM package, especially what they've put together in Python, is that it makes it very easy to then use the model in a predictive sense as well, which I think has not been a focus before.
And so FastLMM is going to actually do this whole thing, this process up here, make sure to get the right gamma from this K matrix that we're never going to build because it takes too long, right?
Exactly.
And then it's going to output sort of the actual regression model.
Exactly. A format that makes it easy to predict. That's exactly right. So I won't go too much into this, but it's basically taking an expression for the log likelihood, mm-hmm. And figuring out what these variances are from.
Is that a logistic regression that it's doing then?
So it's a linear regression. It comes up looking up like a linear regression model.
Okay.
Exactly. But you can imagine if you had traits that were binary. That there might be a variation on this where you wanted to use logistic regression and just say, is it yes or no as your final answer.
Oh, I see. So yeah. Logistic regression will do yes or no, like for classification instead.
Exactly, yeah. In this case, what you can do is you can take the values that come out of this, which are going to be continuous, and try different thresholds and basically say, this above this threshold, I'm going to say the person got the disease and below they didn't. And if you try out different thresholds, you might find one that has the best best false positive to false negative ratio. So for something like is this person going to get cancer? You probably are going to be more tolerant of cases where you say there's a chance that you have cancer. We're going to look at it more in depth with another test.
Right.
Then you would say, oh, you definitely don't have cancer. Don't worry about it. Go home and find out later that they did. So choosing a threshold like that is fine. But this is designed to be used to give out a continuous. Prediction.
Fantastic. Well, we know now a lot about biology. We've seen how to actually find the regression. And the trait, the regression is going to tell you the likelihood of you having that particular trait. Is that right?
It's going to give you a predicted. Let's say if it's something like height, it might give you just the predicted.
I see.
Yeah, exactly. Height.
But what about the trait of cancer, for example, in your gene? Is it going to be like between 0 and 1? What's the number going to look like?
Yeah, so unfortunately, it's going to... If all of your training data looks like, these people who didn't have it, I wrote down a 0, and these people who did have it, I wrote down a 1, unfortunately, the values that you'll get out will still... they could be negative, they could be above 1, and it's kind of up to you to decide what does this value... should I predict anything that's greater than 0.5 to be? Depending on where you set that threshold, like I say, you can get more false positives or more false negatives, and depending on what you want to have that ratio look like.
And that's if you're optimizing precision over recall, for example.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. Yeah.
All right, well, let's see how it's done.
Okay, yeah, sure thing.
Let's do it. All right, so let's get into this and see how we actually work all that stuff we did on the board. Let's see what it looks like in real life.
Okay. So we've got this tutorial set up. The fast link for it is aka.ms/trait-prediction, all one word.
Okay.
And what you'll get here is a Git repo that contains some of the files that we'll need. So these are modified a little bit from the HapMap project, which is one source of human genome data.
Okay.
And also some simulated phenotypes. So when we're evaluating how well a predictor works, it helps to have a ground truth that we know. And so in this case, rather than just using real phenotype data, we've created it. But we've created it based on these genome sequences.
And a reminder, phenotype is like a particular trait that we're trying to predict.
That's exactly right,
okay.
Yep. So in the README will walk you through every step. And the idea here, I guess our target audience is folks who are biologists with genome data available that need to know all the steps for actually doing this analysis. So some of these things might not be relevant to the developers who are watching your show, but so that folks know how to easily set up a virtual machine.
Mm-hmm.
We start with that step. So in this case, it's a easy enough process. There's a deploy to Azure button, and you fill in just the bare minimum, the size of the thing that you want, how you're paying for it, and your login credentials. And you're on a roll. Thing gets started, and it comes with Python 2 and 3 already up and running. There are a couple additional packages that we need for this fast LMM approach, and so it'll sort of walk you through how do you connect to this thing for the first time, how do you install those extra packages, and after that it's just about getting the data onto the machine.
Mm-hmm.
So that is a really simple process, of course. And once everything's in place, you know, we start from these files that you know have just the regular genome sequence data, and we can use FastLMM to get started. So you know, there's an additional sort of optional step here where we talk about where this simulated phenotype data came from.
Okay.
For that, if people are interested, they can launch up and see the experiment where it was done. This is part of the Cortella Intelligence Gallery.
Okay.
So these, if you've never seen it before, what these experiments look like, and my screen is a little small here, what these experiments look like are sort of a web of different modules. So starting up at the top, we bring in the data. We put it in the format that you saw earlier, the zeros, ones, and twos.
Mm-hmm.
And then we basically choose some of these sites in the genome at random to be the sites that are going to affect the phenotype, and everything else will have no effect.
Mm-hmm.
So we figure out what each person's phenotype should be based on those random choices.
There you go. That's
a little bit. Perfect. Oh, yeah, thank you. Yeah. And so we're adding in a little bit of extra noise on top of that from different sources, noise that is correlated between people, so maybe it represents the country that they come from. You know, noise that just represents random effects, and then other environmental correlates that.
And you're adding this data again to do regularization.
Exactly. Yeah, we want to see how well this performs when you know we have these sort of non-ideal conditions, all these extra features that don't contribute anything, just like we'd expect in a real problem, and all these extra sources of noise. So that's well, you know, what we get out of this is something to Azure Blob Storage, and that's where we sort of are able to bring it in from. So the experiment talks about that. The tutorial talks about that. So there's a description of what's happening in each of those modules if you'd like more detail. Now we get to the real the fun part where we bring in FastLMM and actually start figuring out what is happening with these effects.
Mm-hmm.
So what I'm going to show you a plot of here in a moment is a plot of the negative log probability of seeing a certain correlation between each site in the genome and the phenotype.
Okay.
And we call that a Manhattan plot. And the reason is that if you have multiple chromosomes, so you're looking at sites from multiple chromosomes, it'll look like there are these peaks. This is actually showing you just one chromosome, but you can still see some kind of peaks coming up here. So it's designed to look like the Manhattan skyline, I say. And so the idea here is, so I've colored in red the actual things that were chosen to be causative, the mutations that actually matter. And you can see that a lot of times mutations near them have also been pulled up in high probability. And they're basically hitchhiking along because they're near these other sites. If somebody has one mutation, they're likely to have the other, and that makes it look like a false positive.
So what is this actually plotting? You're taking the probability value and you're taking the negative log of it. Why is that?
That's just to create basically rescale and make it a little bit easier to visualize by sort of flipping the orientation
and
here.
And just for those that don't remember. Yeah. If you're taking the logarithm of a fraction, it's going to be negative, and so you multiply it by a negative. And this is just sort of to scale it and make it look and have a sort of a sense of where everything's peaking.
Exactly. Yeah. So we have you have an indicator line to give you what might be considered a cutoff for. This is actually considered a conservative measure for significance, called the basically the Bonferroni correction to the probability here. So that's for 5%. And so you can see a fairly large fraction of things are actually peaking out above that. And those would be false positives if our end goal were trying to figure out which sites in the genome actually were important. But what we actually want to do is figure out how we predict the traits. And so it turns out that even without doing this step perfectly, we can move on and see what those predictions look like. You can read through a little bit more detail about how this package works, but it's almost like using scikit-learn. You train and predict functions, that's where we're starting from here. Just bringing in these data from that start out as A's, T's, G's, and C's, and splitting up the people that we have on hand into a training set and a validation set. That way, we can tell how well we're overfitting, by looking at the people who weren't used in the training step.
Looks like you're doing an 80-10, 80-20 split.
That's exactly right. So depending on how many people you have or what your actual circumstances are, you might be interested in only the last 3 months' worth of people that came in or something. You could do this split different ways. But so you can see this is, we set up our model. We run a fit using phenotypes that we simulated. So the marker data, that's referring to the genotype data, genotype markers. And these are environmental covariates that we simulated as well. From that, we try to estimate what this heritability was for our trait. That's a sort of technical measure that I'm not sure will be of interest to everyone here. But you know, we can figure out what we would have expected that heritability to be based on the noise terms that we added in. So there's a description here of how well we did. We did very, very well. And then the question is, so how well can do these predicted phenotypes compare to what we what the true values that we simulated?
Sure.
And what we find is that we're predicting this with like an R squared on the order of 50%, which maybe that doesn't sound so great, but for studies like this, that's actually fairly amazing for these predictions. So it's accounting for 54% of the variance. And that's in this particular case where we've added in a lot of extra sources of noise, that's pretty close to the best that you could do, because the rest of that noise is contributing to the variance in phenotype.
Well, this is awesome. It's been cool to see like how you go from the raw data into something that's digestible, and then how you actually had to use sort of this other fast LMM to do some better regularization, and then to prediction, and then sort of the output of this. It's pretty cool.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So let's go to that website again. There's a way for you to just do this right away by yourself, right? aka.ms.
/trait prediction.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't sure everyone would want to spell phenotype, so this takes you just to this tutorial from which you can launch to all the other links that I'm showing there.
Fantastic. And again, this is going to create a virtual machine to do this data science for you.
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, this has been so awesome. Thanks so much for spending some time with us. She's been laying down the knowledge on biology and how to predict phenotypes based upon gene variations. Thanks so much for watching. Again, we're in the Cambridge office for Microsoft. My name is Seth Juarez, this is Channel 9, and we'll see you next time. Take care.